It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
What's up, football fans? Kevin Smith with you for episode 52 of The Call Sheet here on the Fans First Sports Network. Hey, if you get an opportunity, subscribe to our YouTube channel, FFSN YouTube. You can follow me on Twitter at KT Smith FFSN. And this week I'll be launching a new Twitter account, the Coach's Call Sheet. I'll have more details on that soon. That's going to be a hub for all the stuff I've been doing: podcasts, video breakdowns, articles, everything that's popping up on the Fans First Sports Network from me and from, you know, that'll be my sheet or my hub. And then we're going to have hubs for some of the other things that we're doing. So some exciting stuff happening here at Fans First. And also exciting, we are a week away from the NFL draft, 1 week away from the draft. If you're listening to this on Thursday, by the time we get to episode 53 next week, it'll be draft day. So I'm going to do something a little bit different here at the beginning of the show for episode 52. I like to take a player who wore the number and profile them. And there's some great choices at number 52, some complicated choices. I think of two guys who jumped to mind: Pittsburgh Steelers center Mike Webster, right? The cornerstone of Pittsburgh's offensive line in the 70s when they won four Super Bowls, and Baltimore Ravens middle linebacker Ray Lewis, the heart and soul of that great Ravens defenses of the late 90s, early 2000s. Both of those guys were Hall of Fame players, Super Bowl champions, tremendous competitors, tough as nails. Mike Webster, undersized by today's standards. He was about 6'2" and 250 pounds playing linebacker. That's a small tight end in the NFL these days. I'm sorry, playing center. I said linebacker, I meant center. Yeah, that's a small tight end. That's a big running back in the NFL these days. And Mike, you know, Mike Webster's story is complicated, as I mentioned, because he wound up dying with complications related to dementia. Some of it, obviously some major CTE issues, much of it brought about by steroid use. Webster was one of the first guys from the 70s and 80s era to talk openly about his steroid use and how it had affected him mentally and emotionally. And Mike Webster, in many ways, sort of kicked off that conversation about some of the habits and practices of football players from that earlier era, and really sort of has led to some of the reforms in the game today. Ray Lewis, obviously, he's a fascinating story for some of the things that happened off the field with him. Part of a murder trial back in 2000. For the stabbing of two young men outside a nightclub immediately following Super Bowl 34. And Ray Lewis was acquitted of that. A lot of people have questioned what his involvement may have been. The very next year, he went on to be the defensive MVP of the league as the Ravens won the Super Bowl. And a lot of people can't really separate the two. You know, Ray Lewis, the star linebacker from, Ray Lewis, the guy who narrowly avoided a murder conviction, and how obviously his story would be much different had that jury seen it differently. So I mean, these are complicated guys with tremendous football legacies, but also broader conversations off the field. And I bring those two guys up briefly here at the beginning of the show. They're certainly worthy of talking about when we have the number 52 in front of us. But I occasionally like to use the number to represent something else as far as football is concerned. And when I think 52, the first thing, when I hear 52 as it relates to football, the first thing I think about is the 5-2 defense. Now, and so let's talk for a minute here in part one of the show about the 52 defense. Historically, there have been two variations of this defense. It is one of the most tried and true schemes that you can analyze, that you can access, study, play, etc. And many of the people who may be listening to this show right now, if you played youth football or high school football in the 1980s, 1990s, even into the early 2000s, you probably played some variation of the 52 defense. But it's pretty much obsolete at the major college and NFL level now. And that's what we're going to talk about briefly here is why. What happened to the 52 defense? So, okay, let's talk about its history and where it went. So, as I mentioned, two significant variations of it historically. I mean, the first goes all the way back to the 1940s, the World War II era. The defense created by a coach named Greasy Neal, Earl Greasy Neal. Great old school football name. And, you know, in that variation of the 5-2, you were pretty much playing an eagle defense. So a 52 eagle looks like this. You've got a nose who covers the center, a zero technique right on the head of the center. And then you've got two, what are called three techniques, which are defensive tackles who align on the outside shoulder of the guard. So basically the center and both guards are covered. Pretty hard to run up the middle. And so you can understand why they came up with that variation. Why did Greasy Neal scheme his front as such in the 1940s and 50s? Because in the 1940s and 50s, football was played between the tackles. You wanted to run the ball up the gut as much as possible. And in this configuration, by covering the center and both guards, it made it hard to do so. It made it hard for those guards to pull and get to the edge as well. Tough to block a puller when he, or tough to block the guy on the head of the puller from that configuration. And the rest of the scheme looked as follows. You had two defensive ends who lined up out wider, predominantly over the tight ends. Almost all the offenses in the 1940s and 50s used two tight ends. And the defensive end's job was to line up over top of them, jam them so they couldn't get out for a pass. And now you had the linebackers who sat wide. They were out wide in the C gaps. So that was the 52 Eagle, the original variety of the 52. But offenses, you know, tricky as they are, they caught on eventually. And one of the things offenses recognized was that version of the 52, which also included, generally speaking, two safeties behind it aligned out on the hashes and then two corners out wide, that version had a significant hole in the middle of its defense in the passing game. With those linebackers out wide in the C gap and the safeties out on the hash, if you could get a receiver down the middle of the field, it was pretty difficult for the defense to cover it. And so offenses started to spread themselves out a little bit. Nothing like the spread game that we recognize in football today. But what did they do? They took one of their running backs and lined him up as a wing back or a slot back, a guy a little bit out wider than the tight end, made it so that the defensive ends couldn't jam them. They were occupied with the tight ends. And now you could release that wing back or that tight slot up the seam and split the safeties, and you hit a lot of home runs that way. And it's interesting, the first team to really defensively try to counter that was the New York Giants, who in 1956 invented a version of the 4-3. And what they did, and this is interesting, rather than insert a linebacker on the field, the Giants took their nose tackle and just backed him off the ball. So now basically you had a nose tackle playing middle linebacker. And there were weaknesses to that, of course, but it was an early attempt to counter the fact that offenses had discovered the hole in the middle of the 52 Eagle. So the adaptation that was more effective really came about in the 1960s when Oklahoma head coach Bud Wilkinson developed his version of the 52, which is now commonly called the Oklahoma. And it's called the Oklahoma because Bud Wilkinson, head coach at the University of Oklahoma, essentially invented it. And this defense, really brought those backers in a gap. That's all it really did. You still had a nose guard, but he didn't generally line right on the head of the center anymore. He bumped to a shade. He would shade to one shoulder. And then you would take one of those defensive ends and you'd bump, or tackles, I should say. You had two, three techs. One of them now bumped out over the tackle, and he was what you called a five tech, playing on the shoulder of the tackle. And that allowed you to take one of those linebackers and now kick him inside to the B gap in between the center and guard. And just by moving him in, or I should say the guard and tackle, and just by moving him into the B gap, you allowed that middle linebacker or that strong side backer to be able to close off the middle of the field a little bit better in passing routes. And so that modern version of the 52, the Oklahoma, which now has two varieties or two versions based upon where you put the nose, the overfront or the underfront. In the overfront, the nose is kicked to the tight end side, the strong side. And in the underfront, he's kicked to the weak side. But those are the common versions of the Oklahoma, right? And so defenses played almost overwhelmingly the Oklahoma look all, you know, through the 60s, the 70s, and up into the 1980s. But then, of course, offenses changed again. By the time you get to the 1980s, the passing game was becoming much more prevalent in the NFL. And it wasn't just because offenses were now using wingbacks. Now offenses were using multiple wide receiver sets. They were motioning players from one side of the field to the other. They were using true slot receivers. I mean, most offenses still based out of some sort of 12 or 21 personnel look, but the 11 personnel sets were starting to make their mark. And that was now causing defenses to sort of stretch more. And as the passing game got more and more prevalent, began to tick up over 50% of all plays called, getting itself to the into the mid-50s, defenses had to come up with a new counter. And that new counter became the 34. The Pittsburgh Steelers were the first team to really use a 34 defense. 1981, that's when Chuck Knoll came up with his first variety of the 3-4. And the Steelers have used it ever since. It's been their base defense ever since then. And the only real change that there was, if you draw up a 5-2 in Oklahoma or a 3-4, it looks exactly the same. The difference is not X and O's, it's not scheme, it's personnel. What the 3-4 did was it removed those run-dominant, old-school defensive ends in the 50 front, and it replaced them with the hybrid outside linebacker type, a guy who was more athletic, a guy who could rush the passer and then occasionally drop into coverage. And, you know, that was a term that was never used before, outside linebacker, because linebacker insinuated something happening between the tackles, not outside the tackles. And the outside linebacker now was a modern version of the old school 50 defensive end. And it allowed defensive coordinators to get way more creative. It really revolutionized the game. By the late 80s, most NFL teams now, the majority were playing some version of a 3-4, because those hybrid outside players, who today we call them edge defenders, right? Their name has sort of evolved again. They could do so much, man. They were there to set the edge, thus edge defenders, in the run game, just like old school 50 defensive ends. But they also could rush the passer. They could drop into coverage. You could loop them down with creative stunts into the A-gap. I mean, the 34 linebacker became very, very quickly one of the most dominant defenders in the NFL and one of the most important, as the passing game just got more and more valuable. So the 52 defense, which originated with the intention of loading the line of scrimmage with big bodies to stop the rushing attacks that dominated football in the middle of the 20th century up until the early 80s, that's now the 3-4 defense, which is swifter and it's more versatile, and it exists as sort of an evolutionary element of the direction in which the game has increasingly been headed for the past 40 years. And this is a really timely topic, given the fact that the NFL draft is just a week away. I mean, last year we saw 6 edge players taken in the first round, and this year we're going to see 4 or 5. The men who are tasked with blocking these edge rushers, the offensive tackles, and the players who throw and catch the football, you know, the thing that has now become the defining element of the NFL, the passing game, and for which edge defenders are now so important, that those position groups, offensive tackle and quarterback, they're expected to be the deepest and best position groups in this upcoming draft. So after the break, here's what we're going to do. We're going to examine those groups. We're going to examine the offensive tackles. We're going to examine the edge rushers. We're going to examine the quarterbacks, the wide receivers. And, you know, we're going to do a little bit of a draft history. What does recent history say about where we can find the draft's best players? What position groups? And also, how many players typically from a draft make a team's roster each year? What should you expect as a fan from the team that you follow in terms of draft picks? How many should make the team, and how many should you expect to wind up being starters for your team? It's really interesting. You can learn a lot, and it's probably, in both instances, the numbers are probably a lot lower than you think. Where do players most often bust in the draft? What percentage of players drafted go on to be cornerstones of their respective franchises? It's a lot lower, man. The draft is an inexact science, and the success number is pretty low. So we're going to dive into that. We're going to crunch the numbers on the draft and examine the position groups that have been the most successful, the most difficult to pinpoint a quality player at, et cetera, after the break. So come on back. Kevin Smith, you back on the call sheet. In part two of the show, we're going to take a deep dive on next week's NFL draft. And in particular, we're going to look at what should fans expect for their respective favorite teams in terms of players that they're going to acquire in the draft. How many do they think can make the team, or should they expect to make the team? How many star players might they add? And at what positions are they most likely to find reliable players? So let's jump in. Recently, Lance Zierlein of NFL.com did a pretty interesting evaluation where he broke down all the position groups by potential in the upcoming draft. And he identified star caliber players and future stars and players he felt would provide overall depth. And generally speaking, he concentrated on prospects who are most likely to be drafted in the first five rounds. And in coming up with his calculations, he weighted star players and future starters twice as heavily as players who he thinks are just going to be depth pieces. And in the end, offensive tackle, wide receiver, and quarterback were the top three groups in this upcoming draft in Zierlein's rankings. And over on CBS Sports, they did a similar study, and they determined that the same three position groups would be the strongest. Their study flip-flopped wide receivers and offensive tackles at the top. But again, wide receivers, offensive tackles, quarterbacks, they seem to be your safest bets in this draft, where teams in need of those players should be able to find a good one. But let's take a little bit of a broader view of the subject. What does recent history suggest? I'm a history teacher. I like to know what the past says about the present. And all drafts are different. And this current crop of receivers and tackles and quarterbacks, they're independent of any other draft. But when you go back and you look at the position groups that have been the most successful in recent years, and those that have traditionally struggled, we can get a feel for what to expect from this season's draft class. So, what does history tell us? What might we expect as we try to forecast the NFL future of the players likely to be selected from these groups? So first, let's look at some numbers that should give us a level of expectation for the draft as a whole. How many draft picks can a team expect on average to make its roster, and then of those to become starters or even stars? So between 2011 and 2020, that's a 10-year period, 95% of the players taken in rounds one and two overall made the roster of the team that drafted them. So if you take a guy in the first or second round, he's almost a lock to make your roster. And that number stays high for third rounders, 85%. So again, man, first three rounds, there's a really, really overwhelming chance that that guy's going to make your roster. Now, in those rounds, you want impact players. You don't just want roster guys. And we'll get to that in a bit. But those guys are almost certainly going to make your roster. When you get to the fourth round, it's about two-thirds of those guys, 66%. It's about half for the fifth round, 51%. And then it drops down to about a third, 32%, for rounds six and seven. So when you do all that math, cumulatively then, in a typical draft where seven players are selected, five should make the roster, six if you're really good. And, you know, if your team cuts more than two players from its draft class, then it probably means one of two things. It means that either your team is exceptionally deep and you don't really need a lot of young talent, or more likely, you probably made a mistake or two in the draft evaluation process. So, okay, well, while 5 or 6 draft picks making the roster seems like a good number, many of those picks are short timers, meaning they're either cut or they're released after a year or two. So the reality is that most draft picks don't work out. Whether they're busts or they didn't live up to their draft position, or they had an injury, an off-the-field issue, maybe they stuck around for a year or two, but they didn't move the dial. They never played that much. The truth is just this, man. Most guys that get drafted don't really make a difference in the team's long-term success. So a more insightful metric on how effective a team's draft class is than simply how many make the roster is probably by looking at how many become long-term producers with that team. So the 33rd team, great website, the 33rd team, a lot of former NFL executives, players, coaches, et cetera, involved in some of the writing that goes on over there. 33rd team did a study based on the 2010 to 2017 NFL draft classes. So 8 years of drafts there, 2010 to 2017. And all those guys have now completed their rookie contracts. And what the study did was it gauged the effectiveness of all the players selected in those drafts. And in particular, how many signed a second contract with the team that drafted them. So here's what they found. There were over 2,000 players selected in those 8 drafts. 69% were either cut outright or released within 2 seasons. That's pretty striking right there. But 70% of those 2,000 plus picks were gone from the team that drafted them in 2 seasons or less. 23% became reliable starters, which they defined as as 2 to 3 years minimum as a starting player. But they did not sign second contracts with the teams who drafted them. So 23% of those players, you got a couple years out of as your starter, but then either you moved on from them, they moved on from you. So, you know, do the math, man. 69% and 23%, that leaves us just 8%. That's a tiny, tiny little number. So only 8% of those picks became long-term starters or Pro Bowl players or even guys worthy of Hall of Fame consideration. 8%, that's it, are big-time scores, home runs, so to speak. 23%, roughly a quarter, are productive picks that give you a few good years. But again, man, the overwhelming majority, 70%, have virtually no impact with the team who drafted them. So in that same time, again, 2010 to 2017, about 12% of those 2,000-plus players who were drafted signed second contracts with the team who drafted them. I mean, this isn't because, you know, everybody else was a bust. Like, we just kind of hashed that out. Many of these guys opted to leave in free agency on their own. Some of them were traded. But obviously, the numbers suggest that the odds of drafting a player who will become a fixture for the franchise, are those odds are slim. 8% who become really, really cornerstone type guys, and only 12% who sign a second contract. Okay, so now that we've laid that out, let's answer this question. Where can you find these fixture type players in the draft? I mean, not surprisingly, round one's your best bet. 54% of the round one picks in that 8-year period became starters for at least 2 to 3 years with their original teams, and 31% signed second contracts. So the first round guys, the numbers are fairly good in terms of finding dependable starters and then guys who go on to sign second contracts. But the numbers, they fall way off from there. So, you know, what's the bottom line? The bottom line is this. You know, we're all very optimistic as we head into the draft with high hopes for our favorite teams. Everybody's hoping, you know, you knock it out of the park. You know, the guys who do draft grades the day after the draft ends, which I always think is hysterical, but whatever. You're hoping to get an A from those guys. And more importantly, you're hoping to get an A from them 3 years down the road when they review that draft and they regrade it. you know, we have this sort of list of team needs that we all want checked off. And in the draft, that's the time to do the checking. But the numbers say this. If you get two guys from the draft who become starters for your team over the next few seasons, you've done pretty well. You know, if one of those guys goes on to sign a second contract and become a cornerstone of your franchise or even a star, that's great. And if you get a couple of role players in there who can give you some depth before they inevitably depart, well, even better. Two role players, one mid-level starter, one cornerstone. If you can get that from the draft, you've done well. That's what the 33rd team study really showed us. All right, so back to this draft then. And to the position group suspected to be the strongest, if you're looking for players to check those boxes, you know, become role players, starters, etc. If you're drafting from these position groups, the numbers say you have a pretty good chance of landing a starter or even a star at tackle and receiver, but much less so at quarterback. So between 2011 and 2020, the most recent sort of decade to have been completed, 83% of the offensive tackles drafted in round one became starters. And in round two, 70% became starters. In round three and four, that dropped down to 34%. But still, all those numbers rank the highest for any position group. If you want a starting caliber offensive tackle, odds are you can find one for sure in rounds one and two and even have a decent shot in rounds three and four. At wide receiver, the numbers are not quite as good, but they're still pretty strong. 58% of those taken in the first round between 2011 and 2020 became starters, 49% in the second round, and then 25% in rounds three and four. So decent numbers, decent chance that you'll get a starting quality receiver in that mix somewhere. But for quarterbacks, the numbers are really interesting. 63% of first rounders overall became starters, but there's a cutoff within that round, and that cutoff is quick. Quarterbacks taken in the top five had a 71% success rate or chance of becoming starters, but outside of the top five, it plummeted all the way down to 24%. So beyond round one, finding a starting quarterback is nearly impossible. The second round produced a 24% success rate. Round three, 14%. Round four through seven, it falls all the way to 3%. So if you draft a quarterback in rounds four through seven, clearly you are drafting for a backup because only 3% of those guys became starters. Dak Prescott, Gardner Minshew, Brock Purdy. That's it. I mean, there's some guys like Sam Howell and Jared Stidham and Aiden O'Connell who were post-round three picks who are listed as current starters, but they fall outside the boundaries of the study, and it's really too honest or too early to tell if they're going to become more than placeholders at their positions. Honestly, I think those franchises will move on from those guys as soon as they find somebody they like better. So what's the bottom line? The bottom line is pretty simple. If you're looking for a starting quarterback in this draft and you're picking outside the top five, Good luck. So what's that mean in real terms? Well, you know, for the teams at the top of this draft, Chicago, Washington, New England, they pick one, two, and three, and they all need a quarterback. Recent history tells us they got about a 70% chance of landing one. But for the Vikings and the Broncos, who pick 11th and 12th respectively and are also quarterback needy, their odds of finding a starter plummet all the way down to about 24%. So the question is, do the Vikings or the Broncos trade up to take their guy? Or do they sit, maybe jockey with each other a little bit, trade up to eight? I don't know. I'm just randomly picking. That's the Falcons, whatever. Just to get ahead of the other and then take that fourth best guy, whoever that might be. Opinions vary on, you know, who's in that top three, who's in that top four. And, you know, they have to gamble, right, that guy will be a quality starter, even though he's taken outside the top five. And even though that means the odds that he'll be that quality starter fall dramatically. This is some of the best intrigue in the draft. And it really makes what being a general manager means so hard. You have to get your board right. You got to get your data right. The draft has to fall a certain way for you. And then you got to hope that the coaches you've hired can turn that prospect into a quality NFL player, and your job is riding on all of it. So good luck. So for teams drafting tackles and receivers, you have a much better chance at success. There were four offensive tackles taken in round one last year. Paris Johnson Jr., Darnell Wright, Broderick Jones, Anton Harrison. All four were starters by midway through their rookie seasons, and all four graded out as above average players per PFF. I mean, that's pretty impressive for a group of rookies. The first round receivers weren't as good. Jackson Smith Najigba, Quentin Johnson, Zay Flowers, Jordan Addison. But like offensive tackles, all four were starters. They just didn't rate as highly. Interestingly, the two best rookies from that class, arguably, were Puka Nacua and Rashee Rice, who both of whom were taken much later. So you can probably find productive receivers later in the draft. It's a little harder to do so with tackles, and it's almost impossible with quarterbacks. As for last year's quarterbacks, the jury's still out on those guys. Bryce Young struggled on a bad team. C.J. Stroud flourished on a surprisingly good one. And Anthony Richardson got hurt early and missed most of the season. Those are the only three first-round guys. History says 71% of the all three were taken in the top five, by the way. And history says 71% of the quarterbacks taken in the top five will become reliable starters, which means if we're evaluating just those three guys, history says two of them are going to be really good starters and one of them is going to wash out. And boy, wouldn't you love to look into a crystal ball and figure out who it is? You know, based on last year alone, we might say it's going to be Bryce Young. But, you know, let's see what a new coaching staff and a year of experience can do for him. And then let's see what happens with Anthony Richardson because his sample size is so small. All right, let's put a bow on this. Every draft is different. Trends are not absolutes. But for the analytics crowd out there, if your team needs a tackle or a wide receiver, this is a good draft to get one. And the numbers say that players taken in the first couple rounds at those positions tend to succeed. And if you need a quarterback, well, you'd better get them early, like really early, top five or bust. Oh, and if you need a tight end, well, other than Brock Bowers, who seems like a lock, good luck. Because in both of the studies I cited, tight ends had the highest bust rate and the lowest success rate of any group by far. All right, that's it. That's it for me this week. Call sheet episode number 52. And, you know, boy, man, at this time next week, by the time we talk next week, the draft will be upon us. You don't want to miss next week's show. It's going to be awesome, filled with draft talk. I have a special guest on my show, and we're going to kick around all things on the eve of the NFL draft. So I hope to see you then. For Kevin Smith, this has been The Call Sheet. Have a great week, everybody.